Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. We ended the last show talking about a non-inflationary national dividend or basic income guarantee. Richard Cook is a retired federal analyst who served at the U.S. Treasury Department and now writes and lectures on monetary policy. Using 2006 figures, he noted that the U.S. gross domestic product came to $12.98 trillion, while the total national income came to only $10.23 trillion, and at least 10% of that income was reinvested rather than spent on goods and services. Total available purchasing power was thus only about $9.21 trillion or $3.77 trillion less than the collective price of goods and services sold. What does this mean? Where did consumers get the extra $3.77 trillion? They had to borrow it, and they borrowed it from banks that created it with accounting entries. If the government were to replace this bank-created money with debt-free greenbacks, the total money supply would remain unchanged. That means a whopping $3.77 trillion in new government-issued money might be fed into the economy without increasing the inflation rate. This opens another rainbow-hued dimension of possibilities. What could the government do with $3.77 trillion? In a 1924 book called Social Credit, C.H. Douglas suggested that government-issued money could be used to pay a guaranteed basic income for all. Richard Cook proposes a national dividend of $10,000 per adult and $5,000 per child annually. The U.S. population was about 303 million people in 2007, of whom 27.4% were under age 20. That works out to $2,200 billion for adults and $415 billion for children, or $2,615 billion, which is $2.615 trillion, to provide a basic security blanket for everyone. If $3.77 trillion in greenback dollars were issued to fill the gap between GDP and purchasing power, and $2.615 trillion of this money were distributed among the population, the government would still have $1.155 trillion left over, ample to satisfy its budgetary needs. The concept of a national dividend is interesting but controversial, of course. On the one hand, the result could be a class of drones willing to live at subsistence level to avoid work. On the other hand, a national dividend would be a boon to artists and inventors willing to live frugally in order to explore their art. During the culturally rich Renaissance, art, literature, and science were furthered by a leisure class favored by inheritance. A national dividend would give that birthright to all. Meanwhile, most people desire a lifestyle beyond mere subsistence and would no doubt be willing to pursue productive employment to acquire it. Another proposal favored by a number of economists is a basic income guarantee, a sum of money sufficient to assure that no citizen's income falls below some minimum level. The difference, says Cook, is that a national dividend would be tied to national production and consumption data and might vary from year to year. A guaranteed minimum income would be a fixed figure, paid without complicated paperwork or qualifying tests. However Congress decides to spend the money, the important point here is that using the 2006 figures, the government might be able to issue and spend as much as $3.77 trillion into the economy without creating hyperinflation, perhaps not all at once, but at least over time. The money would merely make up for the shortfall between GDP and purchasing power, gradually replacing the debt money created as loans by private banks. As unemployed and underemployed people acquired incomes they could live on, they would no longer need to take out loans at exorbitant interest rates to pay their bills. Home buyers with money to spare would pay down their mortgages, and fewer subprime borrowers would be induced to acquire new debt, since aggressive lending tactics would have disappeared along with the fractional reserve banking system that made them profitable. Meanwhile, a tax imposed on derivatives could put a brake on the exploding derivatives bubble and its accompanying debt burden. And if the big derivatives banks were put into FDIC receivership, the derivative Ponzi scheme might be carefully unwound, liquidating large amounts of virtual debt with it. As these sources of debt money shrank, there would be increasing room for expanding the money supply by funding public projects with newly issued greenbacks. And I'll continue in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So another possible use for the $3.77 trillion in newfound capital might be to salvage the distressed housing market. Estimates as of 2007 were that the subprime debacle and ARM resets could throw mortgages valued at $1 trillion into default, either because the borrowers could not afford the payments or because they would have no incentive to keep paying on homes worth less than was owed on them. One proposed solution was to slow foreclosures by imposing a freeze on interest rates, keeping ARM rates from going higher. But that would violate the quote-unquote sanctity of contracts, forcing unwary buyers of mortgage-backed securities to bear the loss on investments that had been stamped AAA by bank-funded rating agencies. By rights, the banks devising these dubious investment vehicles to get loans off their books should be held liable. But the banks are already in serious financial trouble and would be hard-pressed to find an extra $1 trillion to compensate the victims. If the securities holders sue the banks for restitution, even the hardiest banks could go bankrupt. So where then can a deep pocket be found to set things right? Today, the world's central banks are extending billions of dollars in computer-generated money to bail out their cronies, but these loans are just buying time without restoring homeowners to their homes or preventing abandoned neighborhoods from deteriorating. So who is left to save the day? If Congress were to issue $3.77 trillion to fill the gap between purchasing power and GDP, it could use one quarter of this money to buy defaulting mortgages from MBS holders, and it would still have plenty left over to meet its budget without levying income taxes. Adding a potential $1.7 trillion or more from a tax on derivatives would provide ample money for other programs as well. After reimbursing the defrauded mortgage-backed security holders, Congress could dispose of the distressed properties however it deemed fair, to avoid either giving defaulting homeowners a windfall or turning them out into the streets. One possibility might be to rent the homes to their current occupants at affordable prices, or at least until some other equitable solution could be found. The rents could then be recycled back to the government, helping to drain excess liquidity from the money supply. And this leads into another way of viewing the inflation problem. The government could create all the new money it needed or wanted if it had ways to drain the economic bathtub by recycling the funds back to itself. Instead of issuing new money the next time around, it could just spend these recycled funds, keeping the money supply stable. The usual way to draw money back to the Treasury is through taxes. Indeed, it has been argued that governments must tax in order to siphon excess money out of the system. But the Pennsylvania experience showed that inflation would not result if the government lent new money into the economy, since the money would be drawn back out when the debt was repaid. And new money spent into the economy could be recycled back to the government in the form of interest due on loans and fees for other public services. A more equitable and satisfying solution than taxing the people would be for the government to invest in productive industries that return income to the public purse. Affordable public housing that generated rents would be one possibility. The development of sustainable energy solutions, wind, solar, ocean wave, geothermal, are other obvious examples. Unlike scarce oil resources that are non-renewable and come from a plot of ground someone owns, these natural forces are inexhaustible and belong to everyone. And once the necessary infrastructure is set up, no further investment is necessary beyond maintenance to keep these energy generators going. They are perpetual motion machines powered by the moon, the tides, and the weather. Wind farms could be set up on publicly owned lands across the country. Denmark, the leading wind power nation in the world, today satisfies 20% of its electricity needs with clean energy produced at Danish wind farms. Wave energy can average 65 megawatts per mile of coastline in favorable locations, and the west coast of the United States is more than 1,000 miles long. The government could charge a reasonable fee to users for this harnessed energy. So these are all possibilities for recycling excess liquidity out of the economy, but today the focus is on getting liquidity into the financial system. Major deflationary forces are now threatening to shrink the money supply into a major depression unless the federal government turns on the liquidity spigots and pumps new money in. We've seen that the money supply could contract by $1.7 trillion or more just from the next correction in the housing market. And when the derivatives bubble collapses, which it will, substantially more debt money will disappear. The Federal Reserve reports that the fastest growing portion of the U.S. debt burden is in the financial sector, meaning mainly the banking sector, which was responsible in 2005 for $12.5 trillion in debt. This explosive growth is attributed largely to speculation in derivatives, which are highly leveraged. The buyer of a derivative might, for example, put up 5%, while a bank loan provides the rest. The debt ratio of the financial sector zoomed from a mere 5% of the economy's national income in 1957 to 126% in 2005, a growth rate 23 times greater than the general economic growth. In 2006, only five major U.S. banks held 97% of derivatives, including the zombie banks that were already bankrupt and were being propped up by manipulative market intervention. The whole edifice is built on sand, and when it collapses, the masses of debt money it created will vanish with it in the waves, massively deflating the money supply, leaving plenty of room for the government to add money back in. In the interest of preserving a single national currency, state and local governments would not be able to issue new greenbacks to fund their programs, although they could issue other forms of credit, such as tax credits for fuel efficiency, which I had spoken about already. However, the federal government could extend its largesse to state and local governments by offering them interest-free loans for worthy projects. That is what Jacob Coxey proposed when he took to the streets in the 1890s, non-interest-bearing bonds to fund local public projects to be issued by the local government and pledged to the federal government in exchange for federally issued greenback dollars. In the 1990s, citizen activist Ken Bonsack took to the streets again, traveling the country for a decade, recruiting scores of public bodies to pass resolutions asking Congress for sovereignty loan legislation that echoed Coxey's plan. Under Bonsack's proposed bill, the government would use its sovereign right to create money to make interest-free loans to local governments for badly needed infrastructure projects. The legislation was not passed, but Bonsack, unlike Coxey, at least got up the Capitol steps and in the door. In 1999, his proposal became the State and Local Government Empowerment Act, introduced by Representative Ray LaHood and co-sponsored by Dennis Kucinich and Barbara Lee, among others. Similar proposals for using interest-free national credit to fund infrastructure and sustainable energy development are being urged by a variety of money reform groups around the world, including the New Zealand Democratic Party for Social Credit, the Canadian Action Party, the Bromsgrove Group in Scotland, the Forum for Stable Currencies in England, the London Global Table, and the American Monetary Institute. And now we'll have a station identification. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Reform advocates note that more money is often paid in interest for local projects than for labor and materials, making public projects unprofitable that might otherwise have paid for themselves. In the modern universal paradigm, Rodney Shakespeare gives the example of the Humber Bridge, which was built in the UK at the cost of £98 million. Every year since the bridge opened in 1981, it has turned an operating profit, that is, its running costs, basically repair, maintenance, and staff salaries, have been exceeded by the fees it receives from travelers crossing the River Humber. But by the time the bridge opened in 1981, interest charges had driven its costs up to $151 million pounds. And by 1992, the debt had shot up to an alarming 439 million pounds. The UK government was forced to intervene with sizable grants and write-offs to save the local residents from bearing the brunt of these costs. If the bridge had been financed with interest-free government-issued money, interest charges could have been avoided and the bridge could have funded itself. State and local governments are good credit risks and do not need the prod of interest charges to encourage them to make timely payments on their loans. To discourage local officials from borrowing free money just to speculate with it, the real bills doctrine could be applied. Expenditures could be limited to real goods and services. No speculative betting, no investing on margin, no shorting. A strict repayment schedule could also be imposed. How would these loans be repaid? The money could come from taxes, but again, a more satisfying solution would be for local governments to raise revenue through fee-generating enterprises of various types, turning local economies into the sort of cooperative profit-generating endeavors implied in the term commonwealth. Another interesting credit option for states would be for them to charter their own state-owned banks, which could then make low-interest loans created with accounting entries on the fractional reserve model, which I will talk about in later shows. Federal, state, and local governments may already be profit-generating enterprises. So says Walter Burian, an investment advisor and accountant who has spent many years peering into government books. He notes that the government is composed of 54,000 different state, county, and local government entities, including school districts, public authorities, and the like, and that all of them keep their financial assets in liquid investment funds, bond financing accounts, and corporate stock portfolios. The only income that must be reported in government budgets is that from taxes, fines, and fees. But the stock holdings of government entities can be found in official annual reports known as CAFRs, Comprehensive Annual Financial Reports, which must be filed with the federal government by local, county, and state governments. According to Burian, these annual reports show that virtually every U.S. city, county, and state has vast amounts of money stashed away in surplus funds, with domestic and international stock holdings collectively totaling trillions of dollars. Some of these stock holdings are pure surplus held as slush funds, funds raised for undesignated purposes. Others belong to city and county employees as their pension funds. Unlike the federal Social Security system, which must be invested in U.S. government securities, the funds in state and local government pension programs can be invested in anything: common stock, bonds, real estate, derivatives, commodities. Where Social Security depends on taxing future generations, state and local retirement systems can invest in assets that are income-producing, making them self-sufficient. The slush funds that represent pure surplus, says Burian, have been kept concealed from taxpayers, even as taxes are being raised and citizens are being told to expect fewer government services. He maintains that with prudent government management, not only could taxes be abolished, but citizens could start receiving dividend checks. This is already happening in Alaska, where oil investments have allowed the state to give rebates to taxpayers, around $2,000 per person in 2000. Burian's thesis is controversial and would take some serious investigation to be substantiated, but combined with allegations by Catherine Austin Fitz and others that trillions of dollars have simply been lost to black ops programs, it raises tantalizing possibilities. The government may be far richer than we know. An honest government truly intent on providing for the general welfare might find the funds for all sorts of programs that are sorely needed but today are considered beyond the government's budget, including improved education, environmental preservation, universal health coverage, restoration of infrastructure, independent medical research, and alternative energy development. Roger Langrick concludes, quote, "With computerization, robotics, advances in genetics, and food growing, we have the potential to turn the planet into a sustainable ecosystem capable of supporting all. This is not a time to be saddled with an 18th century money system designed around the endless rape of the planet, one based on the robber baron mentality and flawed with unrepayable debt. A new monetary system with enough government control to ensure funding of vital issues could unlock the creative potential of the entire nation." Close quote. So now let's look at the government itself. The government with the potential for a heart. In the 19th century, the corporation was given the legal status of a person, although it was a person without a heart, incapable of love and charity. Its sole legal motive was to make money for its stockholders, ignoring such external costs as environmental destruction and human oppression. The U.S. government, by contrast, was designed to be a social organism with heart. The Founding Fathers stated as their guiding principles that all men are created equal, that they are endowed with certain inalienable rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that the function of government is to provide for the general welfare. If the major corporate banking entities that are now in control of the nation's money supply were made agencies of the U.S. government, they could incorporate some of these humanitarian standards into their business models. And one important humanitarian step these public banks would be empowered to take would be to forgive unfair and extortionate third world debt. Most third world debt today is held by U.S.-based international banks. If those banks were made federal agencies, either by purchasing their stock or by acquiring them in receivership, the U.S. government could declare a day of jubilee, a day when oppressive third world debts were forgiven across the board. The term comes from the biblical book of Leviticus, in which Jehovah himself, evidently recognizing the mathematical impossibility of continually collecting debts at interest compounded annually, declared a day to be held every 49 years when debts would be forgiven and the dispossessed could return to their homes. Unlike when Jehovah did it, however, a day of jubilee declared by the U.S. government would not be an entirely selfless act. If the United States is going to pay off its international debts with new greenbacks, it is going to need the goodwill of the world. Forgiving the debts of our neighbors could encourage them to forgive ours. Other countries have no more interest in seeing the international economy collapse than we do. But if they are spooked by the market, they could rush to dump their dollars along with everyone else's, bringing the whole shaky debt edifice down. Forgiving third world debt could show our good intentions, quell market jitters, and get everyone on the same page. Our shiny new monetary scheme, rather than appearing to be more sleight of hand, could unveil itself as a millennial model for showering abundance everywhere. And we will continue this in the next show. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.